One of the things that's really useful about smartness and digitization is that we can look for tails in transport patterns and start to deal with those. So, for instance, we have a situation where you have peak buses. Generally, they pay for themselves, slightly profitable, and then off-peak buses less so. So you get off-peak buses cut away from services because operators are, particularly post-COVID, they're in difficult circumstances. But you get also get a situation where someone's a shift worker, they may get the bus in peak times, but then they need to get home in off-peak times and their bus has been cut. One of the things that we are able to do with digitising transport is to create on-demand end-of-day and beginning-of-day services. Those off-peak services, converting them to on-demand means that they're slightly cheaper to run than a fixed line, well, than an empty fixed line service for sure.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have another great chat with Beata Kubitz. Beata is a transport consultant and future mobility researcher in the UK. I spoke with Beata in 2020 as well as in 2021. So I am very keen to have her back on the podcast for Mobility May to give us an update. In this episode, Beata starts by telling us about her background as a transport consultant and her current work in mobility services, what inspired her to launch her sustainable delivery service using cargo bikes, and what a smart community means to her. We then discuss the importance of inclusivity in smart communities to enhance social mobility, as well as the benefits of both digitizing transport and on-demand transport. And we then discuss the impacts that changing mobility behaviors can have. Beata then talks more about her cargo bike project and how it has evolved since we last spoke, before she tells us about the work she's been doing in other towns in the UK to integrate cargo bikes. We finish our chat discussing the emerging trends of increased use of e-bikes, particularly in public bike share, mobility as a service, and more network planning in the UK. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Beata. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I am so excited to have you back on the pod. I was just having a look to see when was the last time we spoke. And we first spoke in the thick of COVID, although some of the world might say we're still in some kind of thick of something. But we spoke in October 2020, and then we also spoke again in March of 2021. Well, that's when the episodes were released. So I'm so excited to have you back on the podcast, see what you've been up to, but also things that have shifted and changed. So over to you. Tell us about your background and what you're passionate about.
So I'm a transport consultant, and I always say I'm in a transport consultant that's in the everything that's not kind of traditional bus and rail and automotive. I'm in the sort of shared side of things, the digital side of things, the active travel, active modes, and particularly mobility as a service, where you kind of tie all of those together digitally. Really interested in transport data from all sorts of different angles and open data. So that kind of is what I do. The things that I've been involved in recently are to do with bike share. I've been looking at how bike share works best, one of my clients. I also do work on demand responsive transport. Those are the on-demand buses that you can call with an app or over the phone or book in advance in whatever way you want to. And I work on trying to enable that a bit more in the UK particularly. And then I also work on cargo bikes, which has come out of a project it came out of doing some evaluation a few years ago, published in 2020, just before the beginning of lockdown, about adoption of electric vehicles and cargo bikes in Manchester, which was really exciting. It's a proto project of the kind of thing that we're seeing a lot more of these days. It was really great to see, and it was really good to kind of look at what the positive aspects were, what the blockers are, and also how much this project actually did to change the way people were moving around Manchester and lower the carbon footprint of people working at the universities and the city council. So that was great. Then we had lockdown, and then we had people turning to online sales and deliveries and things. And I looked out of my window and went, oh my God, my lane is just going to be absolutely knackered by vans turning up in it, because it was only a kind of dirt track kind of thing, and all of these Mercedes Sprinters were practically queuing to deliver us goods. And my tiny little gesture against this was to go out and hire a cargo bike and launch a sustainable delivery, kind of, you know, just a voluntary service to help out traders in our local town, people who with small shops who weren't getting customers, and people who weren't able to get things they wanted. So it was just a voluntary sort of thing, and it's been great. It's been really fascinating. It was really interesting to see. People were super enthusiastic about it, and I've had a couple of times where, you know, people have turned around and said, right, we've got to keep this in our town, how are we going to do it? And so we've had funding from our local council and also from our town board to try and embed Cargodale in Todmorden. So yeah, so that's what I've been doing. I do a bit of consultancy on cargo bikes as well these days, help other projects that are setting up, whether it's voluntary or commercial or, you know, a mixture of the two. So that's what I'm up to.
I love it. I mean, I remember talking to you about this project and I was just so excited about this, you know, local scale, solving real problems with technology and data, and then also like the scale up, you know, or the potential of then taking those lessons learned to other small towns and particularly regional areas as well, as you were talking about. And people can go back and listen, you know, we've got two episodes there, 194, which was the first one, and then 218. And we did talk a lot about that project. And I guess what I also liked about it is you were talking a lot about the data aspect of it and what you were finding with the data and you know, were things shifting and changing. So I guess we'll get to that. We'll get to things that you're doing and projects, and we'll talk a bit more about that. But let's go broad and let's go back to smart communities. So what is a smart community to you in terms of what you do in this space?
To me, it's a livable community. It's a community where people can walk a lot, where people can cycle safely to do many of their errands and chores and go socialise and meet up. It's where they have access to the right tool for the job effectively in terms of transport, whether that's a cargo bike, a really good quality pavement. I think one of the things that really upsets me is that the pedestrian is like the primary unit of moving people around, and yet sometimes you can have pavements where, or no pavements, and particularly because I live in a rural community or a semi-rural community, so you kind of like find that people don't even have pavements, and that's quite sad, because it means that parents with pushchairs, people in wheelchairs, people wheeling bikes, or, you know, they all don't really get a fair look in. So a smart community to me, it's having that initially, that really good infrastructure for walkers and self-propelled vehicles, cycles, small scooters, things like that. And then it's also having the access through digital and other ways of booking things. You know, I think it's really important that when we're smart, we don't exclude people from being able to get an on-demand bus or, you know, hire a cargo bike. It's easier, obviously, for operators if it's all done digitally. And that does mean that you can streamline your operations, but you still have to leave a kind of analog opportunity for people to be able to participate in new modes of transport. So smart, that's smart to me. It's also about having the transport there as well. In the UK, I do quite a lot of analysis of population density versus what modes people have available. And it's kind of quite disappointing that we have a lot of areas which are slightly less dense, but really don't have any access to buses, particularly the main form of transport in the UK, or the form that moves the most people daily from, you know, in short walkable distances. And particularly, you know, we seem to think that 400 metres is a good benchmark, but it may not be a good benchmark because we have some really steep roads, in particularly in this kind of area that I'm in Yorkshire. We have some 1 in 3 roads, and 400 metres on a 1 in 3 road is very different to walking 400 metres on a flat road, obviously. So yeah, it's about access and having pavements between people's houses and bus stops. You know, if your bus stop doesn't have a pavement up to it, how are you supposed to get there? And if you don't have the drop curbs for wheelchair access so that people can get across the road and cross to the buses or cross to their homes, how are they supposed to get around? And I really think that a lot of smartness is, although the digital end of it, things really helps, it optimizes, it helps connectivity, it really improves a lot of things. The bottom line is it has to have the rails to run on, it has to have the infrastructure to enable it.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And one of my good friends, or one of my good colleagues, actually, Kylie Nixon, talks about really getting that baseline right first, those foundational pieces right. And what she calls the canvas, which is so important. And just any project we do, if it's mobility as a service, if it's, you know, scooters or a new bus stop or new technology, if you don't have those foundations right, then it may work for some of the population, but you're excluding people, like you said, and that's not smart. And yeah, I totally agree with you. So this month we're doing Mobility May, because mobility is obviously very close to my heart, but also it's so foundational for any community, because yes, we can move digitally now, but we want to be able to move physically as well. And I think those things are really innately linked. And also then that, you know, a bit of a change of the term, but I think from a mobility perspective, we also want to talk about upward social mobility and those type of things, and how having physical and digital mobility can really lift us up and help us to help people move between, move up in that social aspect as well. And I think we underestimate that until we really look at it, and we look at the data, we look at, you know, we talk to the people involved, we listen to the stories, and then think about how we can actually solve those things. So yeah, I'm so excited to have you on the pod again and talk about this, but thanks for bringing the analog component back in too, because I think that is also important. And how do we really make sure that it's still the most efficient way to do things, but actually you have those channels for people to be able to access those services?
I think the other thing that we have to also remember is that we are social animals, so we want to do things together. And so if one person in your group has mobility issues, or one person has small kids but you still want to go as a group, you have to have things that are completely accessible to everyone. Because as soon as you say, oh well, you can't, you know, there isn't a lift at that station, so we can't get the buggy, the wheelchair, whatever, up and down to platform level, then no one will use that mode, because everyone will come together, they'll go and get a car. So and then from a social aspect, a social mobility point of view, if you are trying to get out of to increase your job opportunities, to get out to work, if you are forced to drive a car, you can end up in a kind of trapped situation where you're spending more money on your travel costs than you're earning, but it's significantly hampering your earning capacity and potential. And that's something that we see quite a lot. Also from buses in the UK being just really expensive in certain areas, particularly in rural areas where you're traveling a little bit further. So the bus company sees it as perfectly fine to charge a bit more between two towns that are, you know, a few miles apart. But then obviously if you're someone who lives in town A and works in town B, and it's costing you £10 a day to travel to work, you have to work an hour or two to kind of make your travel expenses, which doesn't leave a lot, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it also puts people in more like less secure kind of opportunity, or like feel less secure, because they know, oh, I've got, these are my expenses that I have, but I have to have those to get to the job if I don't do that, you know, or job. And so leaving that gap is less and less. And then, you know, you may not be able to upkeep other certain things. And there's this whole, I guess, you know, obviously so many different issues, but I just think how important mobility is when we talk about it in these terms. And I think just having the awareness, then you can really hyper focus on that and make sure that we are making those, you know, really the best decisions we can when we're working with governments and different agencies.
I think one of the things that's really useful about smartness and digitalization is that we can look for sort of like tails in transport patterns and start to deal with those. So for instance, we have a situation where you have peak buses, you know, generally they pay for themselves, or straight are slightly profitable, and then off-peak buses less so. So you get off-peak buses cut away from services because operators are, particularly post-COVID, you know, they're in difficult circumstances. But you get also get a situation where you have someone's a shift worker, they may get the bus in peak times, but then they need to get home in off-peak times and their bus has been cut. And one of the things that we are able to do with digitising transport is to create on-demand end of day and beginning of day services. Those off-peak services, converting them to on-demand means that they're slightly cheaper to run than a fixed line, and well, than an empty fixed line service for sure. And they also mean that people who maybe will use one trip within the peak envelope and one trip within the off-peak envelope are also served, because obviously if they can't get home, they won't go in the peak envelope either. So you know, I think there are that digitization can really help optimize and create services that do envelop and give people all of the transport opportunities. It's just that we absolutely need to make sure that there are the vehicles and the drivers and the operators there to be able to ensure that people don't have to own a car if they shouldn't really need to.
And I think also what it can do is it can give a bit more security or feels more reliable, where you can rely on it, because you go, oh, now I can see that I know that I can order. I've done it before. My friends told me about it. I know that it's possible. Whereas if you're only looking at a paper timetable, for example, which obviously that still is the case in a lot of different places, but if you're waiting at a bus, 11 p.m. bus or something like that, and it doesn't show up, you don't know if it's coming. Do I catch a taxi? You feel unsafe, particularly if you're by yourself, all those type of things. Whereas technology can add a little bit of that layer of perception of safety and all those things, and reliability as well. Again, thinking about making sure that it is as accessible as possible. And also sometimes that accessibility component is one, you have to be able to afford to have a device and have the internet connectivity as well. So that inclusion piece is really important, and that divide piece is important. But then also just having someone to teach you how to use it, and that can be patient enough. And maybe it's not, maybe it is your child or your cousin or whatever, but maybe it is actually somebody that, you know, that's the service that they're offering as well. So I think there's so many different layers and components that fit into improving that digital literacy for people, so then they can actually feel comfortable catching public transport, you know, whatever time of day it is, and then also having those services. Like you said, they have to be available to be able to do that.
I think it's also a little bit, you can integrate some of these services, integrate transport into services. So for instance, if you're a doctor's surgery and people get there and sort of like need to get home, you know, can you have an iPad in there that helps someone book a trip, their on-demand bus home, for instance? That kind of thing, where it's, you bring transport into the community, it's not so siloed off, can also help.
Yeah, and even if it's offered as part of the, you know, you get the trip is paid for or whatever, or subsidised if you use the bus or whatever the case is to get to the doctor's surgery. There's so many different models that we can enact, and digital and also using the data then helps us to be able to understand where are people coming to and from. Obviously privacy is obviously key, so we're not thinking about that individual. We don't necessarily want to know that, you know, Zoe is going from here to there and what she does every day, but actually that aggregate of people to know what services, you know, maybe then you can think about how you plan that better, or if it's, you know, more people using car trips, maybe that, you know, maybe there is a fixed route option or an on-demand option in a different area or whatever the case, or maybe the bus needs to be bigger or smaller or whatever the case is. But actually looking at that data and making informed decisions about it is really key.
You can also look at one of my clients, Dan Mobility, has run some trials and just launched new services. And interestingly, you find demand. I mean, this is the problem that we don't know what we don't know quite often. So when you launch a service, you have a good idea that you'll have enough people to make it work and utilize it. But then you don't, then the suppressed demand is what it gets revealed by launching new services. And we found quite often that young people are that demand. College students who were relying on lifts before, previously to the services being launched. And it's really quite telling. I think we've, some of the customer survey data, this is in France, said people giving up their second cars because they're not giving their kids lifts as much anymore, which is like, wow, that's quite a big impact from launching an on-demand bus service, because, and suddenly you're also giving young people independence, or enabling them to claim their independence because there's a service there, which I found pretty stunning that you can have such good impacts from one kind of effective intervention.
Yeah, actually, the episode that's going to go out before this one is talking about that, like, behaviour change because that service is available. And he talks about Dan Hendry, his name is, which everyone will have listened to because it'll be next week's episode or the week before this one. We're in the past, future. I don't know where we are. But anyway, he talks about teaching grade 9 students how to catch transit. And then it's free. There's a particular, in Canada, a particular area that they're trialing these things. And it instills that behaviour in. So then they're going to be transit users as they continue to move forward. So that then is, they can teach their friends, they can teach their parents, then this whole network of benefits happens. And I think that's smart, right? Like, and obviously there's data and you know, there's you using the bus and you're using your, you know, whatever card or whatever it is. But actually the smartness is in thinking about the behaviour change that we want in the future. Well, the behaviours that we want to fit in this future that we're trying to shape, right? And so that's exactly what you were talking about there. So I think it's so important, and I'm so glad that this is what we're talking about for Mobility Mate. Like, I think it's not like I'm going to have a range of people on the pod, but yeah, no, I think it's really important and something, you know, we all do, right? But sometimes we don't necessarily think about it.
No, and that is the young people are the, that it's such a trite thing to say, they are the future. But they're the future that is really will be much further up the down the slope to net zero than we are currently. And so, you know, we need to establish all of these things now, that this is the way to get around before it's too late, in a kind of urgent climate kind of way.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the cargo bike project, and then I want to talk about the future. So maybe you can just, you know, last time we spoke, you had a number of, like, a fleet of cargo bikes. What happened since then?
So now we're kind of not doing free deliveries for COVID anymore. So that it's moved to a kind of semi-commercial model. It's a community interest company that we've registered that. And we were bought some cargo bikes by our local town, which was pretty amazing. And we established a little hub in markets. And so we've got some key clients that use our services, and we've established a little bit of a kind of like a veg box, but with a wider selection of things from all the local stalls on the market and shops in the town, which we deliver on Fridays. We've got our local council supporting another delivery initiative to help the market in Halifax, which is like 10 miles down the road work. So we're working on that too. And we've got our bikes in basically three areas. So all doing kind of similar things, slight variations on a theme, slightly differently funded. And we're also doing a project where we're helping people try out cargo bikes themselves and hiring bikes out, which is interesting because we've had a lot of people who are absolutely really delighted to try out cargo bikes and would really like one themselves. But this area of Yorkshire, I don't know if any of your listeners have heard of Coronation Street. We have like kind of houses that go open straight onto the pavements. They're terraced houses. And so people are kind of like, love a cargo bike, don't know where I'm going to put it. Because, you know, it's quite normal to on street park your car, but it's not on street. You know, no one wants to leave a 5,000 pound bike just sitting in the street. So, yeah, so I foresee a future where we are trying to work out a system of bike hangers or something like that in our towns so that people can actually have access to cargo bikes when they want them.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's so interesting. And, like, it's like this second-order problem of bicycle parking, right? Second-order transport problem of bicycle parking. But it's a barrier, right? It's a barrier and, yeah.
Little bikes, well, I mean, a normal bike that's not got the kind of cargo element, people quite often wheel them into their houses and maybe, you know, into the cellar or out the back. Whereas, yeah, because cargo bikes fulfil that kind of slightly more car replacement role, they've got a big bay for shopping or children or whatever, you can't do that. You can't wheel a cargo bike into your house generally, unless you've got barn doors. So so we are into this sort of like, oh, okay, how do we change our streetscapes? How do we change our expectations of parking and bike parking to fit a much more carbon neutral future?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Interesting. Well, yeah, I'm keen to, I guess, continue to follow on and see what happens next. Before we go to the future, I'm just keen, you mentioned that you were doing some other work with other towns. Is this kind of a way to consult or scale the idea?
So basically, in the UK, we have various sort of initiatives which kind of combine and say, and the answer is cargo bike. So we've got future transport zones, which are areas which are kind of testing new technologies and how things might change. And we've also got clean air zones coming up. You know, there's quite a big carbon particulate and nitrogen oxides of nitrogen problem that we have in the UK in our air quality. And so a number of cities are establishing clean air zones where you can't bring in vehicles with certain emissions or you have to pay quite a sort of penalty for doing that. And so things like this are combining. Also high streets, the onlineisation, is that even a word? But you know what I mean? People buying more stuff online hasn't really kind of abated since people were able to go back into shops. So we're still on a trajectory where people are buying more things online. And so local shopping centres are also kind of looking at what can we do to participate in the online economy to support local economies, not just sort of, you know, warehouses out of town. So, and again, you've kind of like all three of these things, people are going, cargo bike deliveries would support on local shops, cargo bike deliveries and using cargo bikes to move things around within city centres that can't, you know, where we've got air quality issues, that will be interesting. And also, you know, future transport, how do we improve things, make them smarter and lower emissions? Again, that's another element where, oh, cargo bikes, can we do, how would cargo bikes play out in this? So yes, so I've been working behind the scenes a little bit on the West of England future transport zone, which covers Bristol and Bath. And yesterday we went and we finally have some cargo bikes in place, partners in the universities of Bristol and Bath and the hospitals all interested in trialling cargo bikes and in their fleets for one reason or another, whether they're to shift samples or furniture or IT equipment around campuses or between departments and, you know, use in all sorts of different use cases. So that's been quite a long-term project because in the UK you have to kind of try and work out a scope, work out a sensible procurement system. You're procuring things that haven't really ever been procured before. So you've got to try and work out what a sensible kind of procurement solution would be for that. And also, this is all kind of voluntary. No one's being forced to do it. So you've got to work with the organisations, with the people within the organisations who will be using the cargo bikes to make sure that they are on board and happy, it's and that you're actually proposing a kind of viable solution for the things that they want to do. So it's all quite interesting. And then there's the data collection element. And so, yes, we've been looking at how we can get trackers put onto all of the bikes and onto the vans that we've been replacing so that you can hopefully in real time see that change in transport patterns, the costs. And obviously, if a van stops driving into a zone where it's incurring a quite high cost every time it does that, you should be able to track what your cost improvements are. And then you should also be able to see what, you know, calculate what your carbon footprint changes are from using that data.
Wow, so interesting. So much in that. And it really goes to kind of, it really talks, speaks to all these different elements that are in, you know, smart community, smart mobility, all those type of things, but also that it's not just about, okay, now we've got this cargo bike. It's procurement, it's regulation. It's like you said, people aren't forced, in inverted commas, to do this at this stage, but potentially down the track, these might be the early movers, right? But then people will be, you know, regulated into doing something because we know we need to reach, reduce our emissions, that type of thing. So yeah, I love it. I think, and it's just continuing that journey that, for want of a better word, but just like using smart things, using different elements, do new ways of doing things to then, you know, push to that future that we want, which is when we're thinking about climate change. So it's not just like, oh, we'll just do all the smart stuff over here. It's like really integrated now into, you know, the things that we're doing. Now, I'm just conscious of the time, so we're going to have to zoom to the future. Let's talk about the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough.
Well, it depends where you are, I think, in the world and what the emerging trends are, because in Europe, I'm seeing a lot of mobility as a service projects emerging, lots of really interesting stuff going on in terms of being able to tie things together digitally, on demand, being tied to a fixed line and buses meeting trains and all of that kind of stuff. Bike share kind of expanding. One of the really interesting things that I've just been doing is a small piece of work looking at whether bike share should be electric or mechanical or mixed. And we looked at the Paris Belib system, which is like the biggest in outside of China, basically. And Paris has until recently had 30% e-bikes and 70% non-e-bikes. And looking at the data, we're finding that the e-bikes get used for something like 10 times a day and the non-e-bikes get used about 4 times a day. So there's we can look at the background information and discover that people are actually looking for the e-bikes, and if then, you know, they're only taking those mechanical bikes as a second choice quite often. And the issues are, and then they're also doing much longer trips. I think I worked out that basically an e-bike will be used for 240 minutes a day, whereas a non-e-bike will be used sort of between 60 and 70. So you've got kind of a really unbalanced fleet, which then creates all sorts of management problems. So I'm beginning to wonder whether we should just go 100% e-bikes in bike share. That sounds kind of sensible to me, because you've got this, the e-bike enables so many more people to ride in terms of like the diversity of the population, the diversity of the end case use cases, you know, people who kind of have to carry stuff, lug it around. It's so much easier if you've got a bit of electrical assistance, as we know from the cargo bikes. It's easier to, you know, you can just go a bit further. You need to turn up an interview looking smart still, not kind of like slightly kind of harassed.
Sweaty.
So you've got all of, you know, I'm kind of looking at this data and thinking, bike share, one of my favourite things, but maybe we should be biting the bullet in cities and going electric and not just mixing it up, because the electric, having a minority of electric bikes means that you've got a system where one set of bikes, the smaller set, is being used absolutely intensively for hours every day, and the other one is the other mechanical bikes are not being used. They're not going as far. They're not spending as much time in use. So you've got this kind of like one set of bikes which need to be managed like all the time because they're sort of being used so much, and one set of bikes that are being used much less intensively and also don't redistribute themselves in quite the same way. You find mechanical bikes at the bottom of hills. Electric bikes tend to get used more evenly across the city. So that's one of the things I'm kind of thinking about at the moment, particularly in public bike share, because, you know, there are a lot of e-bike kind of private e-bike providers out there, but they don't tend to key into public transport in the same way as a public bike share that's been organised with the city, and, you know, where the city's looking at kind of like the social elements and what it wants to achieve with the bike share. So, yeah, that's one thing that I've been looking at. Other trends, mobility as a service. I mean, in the UK, we are finally looking like we're sort of like a very slow oil tanker turning round away from deregulated buses and back towards regulation in buses, because it enables you to plan the network much better. I recently spoke to the Financial Times about buses, and journalists are always kind of like quite kind of astonished. In fact, everyone's astonished when I talk about buses in the UK, that you cannot plan a network outside of London, really, in terms of like thinking where you want to go. Do the buses meet the trains? What are the connections? Because they're all deregulated and the operators can't talk to each other, you know, and about what they're doing, because they're each supposed to be a competing independent organisation. So hopefully we'll see a bit more network planning in the UK. I think public transport worldwide is quite under pressure after COVID. I think acceptance that public transport is a big tool in the path to net zero is probably one of the important things that we need to, whether it's happening or not, we need to see it happening in countries worldwide, and enabling people to do it, making sure that the people have access to public transport, have access to active travel as well. That's the other massive thing. You know, Paris has changed during the course of COVID. Before COVID, it was sort of, you could see there were changes happening with bikes. Now, Paris is a different city from the point of view of active travel lanes, where you have bikes, cargo bikes, scooters, all sorts of things, and so many fewer cars in the centre of Paris. It's astonishing and really heartening that a city can change so quickly. So I think those are all trends that I both support fully and would like to see more of, and I'm delighted to observe in the kind of like in the future.
So much in that too. And I think looking at the data, looking at those insights, but then also like you were talking about earlier, having that network and what those other things that all feed into this kind of smart, whatever, smart community, smart thinking, doing things differently. You need to be able to pull all those other levers, which is why we need so many people involved in these conversations for mobility and for communities in general. Now, Beyonce, it's been so great to chat with you on the podcast. I'm so glad for you to come back on. Like, we could have talked for a lot longer, but we have to wrap it up there. But I really look forward to our next conversation too. I'm already thinking about it. I've got one more question. How can people connect with you?
I've got a website, which is just my name, beatakubits.com. And it's a little bit of a ragbag of random things that I have done in the past whenever I get around to updating, but it's got a form on it. So beatakubits.com is the way to get in touch with me. I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I use my own name. It's fairly distinctive.
Yes. Hopefully no one steals that domain name or stole that domain name from you. It's probably pretty unique and people can remember that. But we'll put all the links in the show notes anyway so people can click away and find you. But yeah, I really appreciate you joining me back on the pod for Mobility May. So yeah, have a great day.
Thank you. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.